scientific and what is not scientific. Now, the scientific, the way of most of what we call, very little of what we call science is just straight observation. Newton's apple, falling apple, gravity is more or less straight observation. But the normal scientific method is called the hypothetical
You got these big words here, Art.
Hypothetical deductive. The scientific process is overwhelmingly a hypothetical deductive process. And here's what it means. A break will divide and conquer. Here's what you do. You start with a hypothesis. You're going to find out what cures cancer. Well, I think eating cranberries cures cancer, or will cure cancer. Or eating cranberries causes cancer. What causes cancer? Cranberries cause cancer. Well, whatever. Whatever your hypothesis is. Then you say, now here's how you test it. You make certain, here's your hypothesis, you got that? Then you make certain deductions. You say, okay, now, we know that if this is true, if cranberries cause cancer, then we should find this, we deduce, therefore we should find this, and we should find this, and we should find this. You follow me? If this is true, therefore, people who eat cranberries should get cancer, when those people who don't eat cranberries don't. People who eat more cranberries and those people who eat fewer cranberries should have more cancer. And people who eat fewer cranberries have fewer cancer. People who live in cranberry-growing areas should have cancer more than people who live in non-cranberry-growing areas. However you want to work it out. And the value of a hypothesis is in its ability to predict. But if it can predict what you will observe, here's the hypothesis. Here's what you observe, maybe in the laboratory or however you observe it. You test it. And if the hypothesis can accurately predict what you have deduced that it should predict, it's a good theory. It becomes a theory. If it continues to accurately predict, it becomes a law. That's how, or what we call a scientific fact. And by the way, there aren't very many scientific laws. And by the way, scientific laws have nothing to do with evolution. You got that? That's called the hypothesis. Now, however, if you start looking and you find this, lo and behold, we found this. It's what but it didn't work here. And we didn't find this. Lo and behold, we found out that people who lived in the cranberry-growing states had less cancer than people who lived, in non-cranberry-growing states. That didn't work. And pretty soon you say, this is not a good hypothesis. Why? It was not able to predict what we would find. So what you do is you move on to another hypothesis. Let's try something else. Cigarettes cause cancer. And if so, we deduce that we should find this, and we should find this, and we should find this. And if we found this, we say this is a good working hypothesis. Now, this whole process, if you're interested in this, I'm sure you might not be, this is an inductive process. All you can establish is a high degree of probability. That is, we think it's a high degree of probability that smoking cigarettes, in many cases, causes cancer. Why? Because of what is observed. But still, in other words, the inductive reasoning produces probabilities, does not produce absolutes. That's just the nature of, that's how it works. Take my word for it. I'm a godfather. Now, what has happened in the evolution creation? Evolution, the hypothesis, we talked last night about how it was worked out. And the theory of evolution could predict what would be found in the fossil record. We make a prediction. We're going to find, if evolution is a matter of fact, the way it was, the way it is, the underlying biological reality, then we would expect to find certain things in the fossil record. We would find, we should find species under certain conditions being able to transmutate into other species. We should be able to find examples. We should be able to see transitional forms in the present order. We should be able to see all these things. Now, and if you don't find them, then, according to the scientific method, what do? You move on to another hypothesis. Now, what has happened since the year, since the early 19th century, the early 1800s, is that you got X's down here. Remember what Goldsmith said? Well, we tried genetics and we found reversion to type, X. We tried paleontology and we got no transitional forms in the fossil record, X. We tried the fruit flies. You got none of the fruit flies. And we tried mathematics. And lo and behold, the mathematician said, they got X's. Why not move on to another hypothesis if we're going to be scientific? By the way, I presented this at Rollins College before the faculty. They said, that's very useful. That's what they say when they, well, that's a code word. That's very useful. Anyway, why not move on? Well, the reason you can't move on, if you're an evolutionist, is there's nothing over here but creation. Yeah. Unless you want to be a Buddhist. And then you don't need this. you got that? There's nothing. In other words, you can't try anything else. It may not be Bible creation, may not be Genesis, but it's creation. I mean, if you don't have non-life producing life, then you got to have life producing life, an antecedent life. And pretty soon that sounds, if you start talking about an antecedent life, that starts to sound like God. And we know that's not scientific. And so, there has been a total unwillingness, general unwillingness to cross over. There's been a barrier here. Stops them, sends them back. Try again. Why? The barrier that keeps them from moving on to the other hypothesis, the only other hypothesis, is a philosophical barrier. As Simpson says, by the way, I don't have the book that Simpson wrote. This is a very excellent book. It's dated now. It's written by a lawyer called Darwin Retried. He's an attorney. He's not a creationist. I don't use creationists, by the way, in dealing with evolution. Don't have to. He's an attorney. He got sick. He was always interested in evolution. So he was laid up for about 6 months. And so he investigated neo-Darwinism. This is before Jay Gould now. This was published some years ago. It's called Darwin Retried. And his conclusion is neo-Darwinism gets thrown out of court. And if I can put my finger, I wasn't going to say this. I'm trying to remember where I found this, so I'm not going to spend much time looking for it. He quotes Simpson in a book that I don't. Here it is. I found it. Now he's criticizing this very unwillingness to try the only other hypothesis. And by the way, what creationists like to point out is that the creation model is able to predict what you find better than the evolutionary model. Creationists, by the way, are more scientific than evolutionists in this sense. Uh-huh. Because if you have creation, you should find what we find. You know, if we had creations after their kind, what do we find? They shall reproduce after their kind. That nothing else has ever been found. The Bible says that life, a living God, produced, took non-life and made it into life. Nothing else has ever been found. You understand? So the creation model predicts. Now, but again, it's still a question of probabilities, which is more, because you follow me? You can't go back and redo creation, or you can't go back in the laboratory, and you can't go back in the laboratory and redo evolution. Understand? All you can show is what might have happened, and what you believe, if you're a rational purpose, you stake your faith, you make your philosophical commitment on the basis of the highest degree of probability. And in the scientific process, that means you take the hypothesis that is the best able to predict. Y'all see that? Well, that's interesting to you or not, but that's how the whole thing works. Now, he said this. He's quoting Simpson. Therefore, it is important to note how he excludes design, that is Simpson, as a matter of scientific principle and method. This is about Simpson. This is one of the Godfathers. I'm talking about why they don't cross over this barrier, or the fact that they don't. The progress of knowledge rigidly requires, this is what Simpson says, the progress of knowledge rigidly requires that no non-physical postulate ever be admitted in connection with the study of physical phenomena. We do not know what is and what is not explicable in physical terms, and the researcher who is seeking explanations must seek physical explanations only. Get that? He must seek natural physical explanations only, which means by the very rules he has set up for himself, he cannot cross over to the next hypothesis. He fails to be scientific. Why? Because that's non-physical. You got a God, and you got supernatural. Now, listen, you kids, listen to this. You must understand this. It is not important. Let me word this carefully. It is not important if you pick up a textbook and the author says, I have investigated the biological order, and I have not come to the conclusion of creationism. It is not important that he says this if you know that going in, that was never an option. A man who says to me, well, it's kind of like the old farmer who came out of the hills, been there all his life, and he went to the zoo for the first time. And he saw his first giraffe. And that giraffe was way outside of his experience. He had never seen anything like that. And so his wife said, what do you think of it? And he said, what do I think of what? He said, what do you think of that animal? He said, there ain't no such animal. What do you think of creation? There's no such thing. Now, you understand, if a man's philosophy, if his worldview precludes the possibility of creation, it is not important that he does not arrive there, because he could not have arrived there. Understand? Therefore, it is not, when you hear this, well, all scientists are evolutionists. First place, that's a humongous lie. Listen, the leaders in this creation-evolution fight, the leaders on the creation side in our generation are not the preachers. The leaders are the scientists. Because, I read about Patterson at Chicago, who got up and announced that creation, they're bailing out. The children are, remember our thing I started with last night, about carrying the dead lady about, and the children are bailing out. Evolutionists every year, by the hundreds, at our top universities, are crossing the line. They're saying, if I'm going to stay on this side of the line, I'm going to have to move over to the philosophy department. But if I'm going to be a scientist, I've got to go on to the next hypothesis, because this one hasn't predicted. And they're crossing over. Some of the top evolutionists in the country, in the world, are. Most aren't. So they say all scientists are evolutionists. But to the extent that that is true, and it's not true, but to the extent that it is true, it is not important. If you understand that they said, well, we didn't arrive at the conclusion of creation. It's not important that he says that if you know that he didn't ever entertain the possibility. That is, if a man doesn't see something, it's not important that he didn't see it if he didn't look. Many people don't realize that. And you know what Simpson said? We are going to consider natural possibilities only. Now, that is a philosophical prejudice. That, by the way, that is not scientific. It's anti-scientific. That's, by the way, well, anyway, I have made my point there, never will. Any questions on this? This is sort of, I took time out, this is how it works. Now, one more thing, then we'll close. You all have been very patient. Let's talk about abiogenesis. Abiogenesis.
That's another word.
Y'all, I'll tell you, do nothing else this weekend. Learn some words, won't you? I am not trying to throw big words at you this weekend, but I do think if we're going to think about this subject, we must think about it in some of the vocabulary of the discipline. If we're going to be able to read, if we're going to read about it and deal with it at all. Abiogenesis is a real problem. What does that word mean? What's the word Genesis mean?
It's a good biblical word. In the beginning. The beginning.
What's bio mean?
Life.
What's A mean?
No. No life beginning.
That means the beginning of life from non-life.
Abiogenesis. Understand?
That is life from non-life. The beginning of life from non-life. Now, here's what's in the textbooks. This is the famous Miller-Urey experiment, and then the Fox experiment. There have been some done since then, but these are the ones that they haven't made. I don't deal with these here because they haven't made it to the textbooks yet. You see, we know that life does not come from non-life in the present system. As the world is now, non-life does not produce life. The order is very... We have in nature, what we call nature... By the way, that's a metaphor. And metaphors don't... I'll just remind you parenthetically that metaphors do not create. I always laugh when in the preface they throw out God and bring in Mother Nature on page 3. I think it's ridiculous to talk about... dismiss God as a myth, introduce nature as a metaphor. You get this. Nature, in her wisdom, knew that the rabbit would need many offspring because all the predators would hunt the rabbit. So nature, in her infinite wisdom, planned for the rabbit to be very prolific. Nature did that, huh? Listen, that is mysticism. That is ancient Eastern pagan mysticism. Talk like that. You say, we say God created. Oh, no, that's not scientific. But nature planned. Oh, well, that's scientific. Yeah, nature. At least God, you understand? At least God exists. Nature is just a metaphor. I said, yeah. I told a fellow one time, I said, nature does. Yeah, I said, I'd like to meet her sometime. Because you see, what they don't mean, you see, it depends on how you say it. You say, I'm just visiting with you now. If you say nature did it, it kind of sounds respectable. If you say, by the most totally improbable piece of blind luck, you never guess what happened. Then they tell it. It kind of comes off. Doesn't sound scientific to say. Even though the odds were 100,000,001 against it, you're not going to believe this. You're not going to believe what happened. And look, really, it was wildly improbable. By pure dumb luck, this is what happened. Would you believe it? Say, well, you right away you'd say, oh well, I don't know about that. You say, nature did it. Oh, I see. Nature did it. Oh yes. Now I understand. Nature did it. Well, anyway, I'm just spoken. But listen, I'm not making that up. That is the vocabulary. That's exactly what's going on. Anyway, there's the evolutionists might say that there is no purpose in nature, but they can't talk about nature without the language of purpose. So they can't do it, and they don't do it. Well. Back to business. The nature as we know it, what is going on now, is it very efficiently destroys life. If you don't think so, just quit eating. You cut down a tree, what happens? Dies. What happens? What's the death rate here in Monroeville? What's the death rate? I know. In Orlando, it's 100%. So far, everybody either has or is. You ever notice how you buy a new car, what happens to it? It starts dying. You ever buy an old car, drive it for 10 years, and all of a sudden it's got no miles on the odometer, got a new paint job, all the chrome shines, and it doesn't use oil? No. It's like an old man, right? An old woman. You know, I've been noticing that at my age. I've noticed that I'm just as fast as I ever was. It just takes longer. Nature is a very efficient killer. It's called the second law of thermodynamics. The natural order is to go from high levels of organization to low levels of organization. You cut down a tree, make a fence post out of it, the fence post begins to rot. It doesn't begin to grow. Now, so if that's the way it is, then how do we get all this marvelous, complex life? Life is everywhere on Earth. You can go to the most dead spot. You can go to the Death Valley, the hottest, driest, deadest square inch of Death Valley. Pick any square inch of rock or sand, and you take it into the laboratory, you'll find thousands of examples of life. There's life everywhere. Well, where did it come from? If you're not going to accept this other hypothesis, where did it come from? You say, and of course, Louis Pasteur was the scientist, was a believer, by the way, who proved finally and unalterably that you don't get life from non-life. That rotten meat doesn't produce flies, and that swamp water doesn't produce frogs. It just looked like that. Ah, you see. But in the primordial earth, way back then, a billion years ago, things were different. And then life just happened. And this proves it. This is a reconstruction of the primordial atmosphere, ammonia, methane, and water. Lightning hit it, producing protein molecules that got together, had a party one night, and formed a cell. A self-replicating cell, we were on our way. The stars were the limit. Well, I was missing my slide. I had a debate on Rollins College campus about a year ago, and there's one professor there who was a young professor, associate professor, who was, we'd been drinking, and he really got mad. He was mad the whole time, and he and his girlfriend or his wife were so mad they met me out on the way to the car, and they didn't like. They just infuriated them what I'd said, and that's all right. I said, well, the thing, your system doesn't work. And they said, what do you mean it doesn't work? And I just talk about, give an outline of what I'm going to give you now. Problem of abiogenesis. And he spluttered, and she said, I'm quoting now, well, honey, we're going to have to admit that is a gray area. Now, calling abiogenesis a gray area is about like calling the sinking of the Titanic a boating accident. A gray area, listen, this is where the whole battle is won or lost. If you listen, let me tell you something. Now, I'm not trying to be facetious, but I told them this. You can talk about evolution all you want to, but you can't have evolution until you get life. And if you can't get life, you got nowhere. You can't even get started. Talking about, you're not ready to talk about going from microevolution to macroevolution until you've got something to evolve, until you've got life, plant or animal life. Now, I'm trying to think what I want to cover and what I don't want to cover. What they did was they took Millard and Urey, I put Millard's, he was the main one, took certain ammonia, methane, and water, and charged it over a long period of time in a container with electricity, and what it produced was certain amino acids in low yield. Now, an amino acid is not a living thing. An amino acid is the basic element in a protein molecule, and a protein molecule, of course, you have to have before you can have a cell. Now, by the way, a protein molecule is about as close to being
a cell, this is an accurate analogy. A protein, if you got a protein molecule, which is vastly complicated, but if you could get a protein molecule, which they didn't, what they got was some chemical globs. But if you had a protein molecule is just as far along on the way to becoming a self-replicating cell as a rusty bolt is on the way to becoming a spaceship. And an amino acid is just about as far on the way to becoming a protein molecule as a rusty bolt is on the way to becoming a spaceship, complete with computers, navigational devices, all the wiring. Listen, the most complicated computer-driven, the ultimate technology in our society is our space program. You take the most complicated computer-driven, computer-guided space vehicle is like a tinker toy compared to the complexity of the simplest cell. Back in 1870, when evolution was kind of getting warmed up, this was before the electron microscope, this was before biophysics, biochemistry, this was way back then, they could talk about life just happening because nobody really knew how very complex life is. Today it is ridiculous to talk about life just happening. If you think life is a bicycle, you might think of it just happening. But when life is a computer, yeah, that's not a very good analogy, but what I'm saying is it's a whole different thing now. Well, and so here is, and so this is put in the textbooks, and what it said is, now they did not get the protein molecule, and certainly didn't get a cell, but we kind of got it. We got a protonoid. I love that. In anthropology, they call them humanoids. This is what's called creation of evidence by label. They didn't get a protonoid. They got a few globs of amino acids, low yield amino acids. And here, they got some real problems with this. First of all, we're pretty sure that the ancient world was never like this. They were very selective in picking just the right gases. Secondly, I don't put all this on here. The low-yield amino acids they got there are two kinds of amino acids. There are amino acids that are called D acids, and they're called L acids. If you're interested, they rate them on the basis of whether they're optically active, that is, they refract light. I won't go into that. But anyway, Miller's mixture got as would be expected, a roughly 50% mixture of D acids and L acids, and that whenever in all the laboratories they have tried to produce these acids, they always get an even mixture of what are called D acids and L acids. As a matter of fact, life consists only of L acids. And the next thing I would say is that this thing doesn't work if oxygen is in the atmosphere. And radiation, light, at that time, if there was no oxygen in the atmosphere, that meant the Earth was unshielded. That meant the Earth was bombarded by radiation. And radiation is a very efficient destructive system. It would have broken down the chemical bond. That is, the mixture would have had to have been far enough underwater that ultraviolet light couldn't get to it and destroy it. But if it was down there, it would have been diffused. You see, what he had to do as soon as he got this low yield amino acid, he had to close it off, move it away from the electricity, and keep it shaking together. If you diffuse it, water diffuses things. So they can't have it in the air because the light would kill it, break down any chemical bonds that would have started to sort of get together. And if you had it underwater, it'd be diffused. And without spending too much time on this, this, by the way, appears in the textbooks. It's absolutely meaningless. It has nothing to do with the beginning of life. You see, to have life, you have to have. Why do you go to the beach, and the sun, and you take if you took your houseplant with you, that's used to being out in the sun, Your plant thrives in the sunlight and you burn. Why? You see, because the plant has something that your skin does not have. It has an efficient energy-converting mechanism, for one thing. Photosynthesis. It takes that which is normally destructive, converts it into useful energy, and produces material with it, plant material. You see, to have life begin, you have to have three things. Three things. You have to have an open system. That means you have to have an energy source coming in. Well, they say, well, lightning struck it. Lightning struck the soup, gave us life. But that's not enough. You have to have an energy-converting mechanism. Otherwise, all that it does is blow it apart. And third, and this is even more important, you have to have information. You have to have something already there to give direction to this building. You follow me? Your energy-converting mechanism converts this into useful energy, but you have to have information there to tell it what to do. In the cell, we call it encoded DNA. If you have any of those missing, if you don't have an energy source, if you don't have an energy converting mechanism, if you don't have information, coded information already there directing it, you get nothing. You get what they got. Lifeless globs of low-yield amino acids in no sequence whatever. It is utterly, listen to me, it is utterly deceitful, utterly untrue. It's ridiculous to offer this as an important experiment as regarding abiogenesis. It has nothing to do with abiogenesis. Now, let me show you what I mean. The simple human cell. Do you realize that a single human cell, theoretically, you can clone a cell and get an identical person. Got that? Theoretically, you can clone a human cell and get an identical person. Why? Because every human cell has all the information stored to make a whole person. Plus, it has an encoded program, like a computer. It's got an encoded pre-program to tell when the cell division begins, as the person develops in the womb, to tell certain cells to become eyes and certain cells to become lymph glands and certain cells to become toes and certain cells to become toenails. Listen, just the basic sequential information in a single cell equals the information in 9 sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica. And that's just the information. That is not the organization that tells how that information is to be used. And lightning striking a bunch of gases in a laboratory has nothing to do with this. Or electric charge strike, run through these gases. Are you with me now? To have life, so we're talking about an amoeba or a paramecium or any single, you got to have it somewhere along the line. You've got to have a cell. And see, as the evolutionists word this, the problem is, see, all you've got is these inert gases. And they get, these outside forces are brought into them. But somewhere you've got to have a transition where the ability, where the ability to survive and reproduce works from the inside of this thing. Because the outside forces simply diffuse it. There has to be something inside it to take the energy and convert it usefully. That's why, is that making sense to you? And so the primordial earth, if it was ever like that, which probably wasn't, good evidence that it wasn't, excellent evidence that it wasn't, would have been a very efficient destructive system. There would have been nothing about it that would have been constructive. Not one thing. The fact that the electrical charge doesn't do anything. Are you with me now? And so all this, you got to have three things. You understand? You've got to have the basic materials. We'll grant them that. You understand? You got to have an energy source. You got to have an energy converting mechanism, which is very complicated. And you got to have encoded information to set the direction for that work that this energy converting mechanism does. All they had is one of the three. Understand? If there had been an energy converting mechanism, It would have just been. It would have been like. It would have been like. It would have been like a big pasteboard box full of random letters. It would not have been like a book, information that's ordered. It's in sequence. You see, this is why I say it is. Takes more faith to be an evolutionist than it does to be a Christian. And this comes through nowhere any more than it does in the area of abiogenesis. Now, what Fox did, I don't spend much time on this. Fox started with amino acids. He started with what Miller was trying to get. He just made this jump and he started with the right amino acids. And he cooked them, was trying to get proteins. He got protonoids. It's not a protein, it's a blob of acids. He only got, of the 22 essential amino acids, only a few will unite spontaneously. Others require high energy. They naturally break down, not cling together. Hemoglobin is a simple protein with 22 amino acids in it, but they're not just that. They're in 400 exact positions. And if only one is in the wrong position, the thing falls apart. It's like having, not just, you say, well, we got these amino acids and we sort of got protonoids, we got clumps. Well, they didn't. Well, yeah, that's all they got. But they weren't protonoids. It'd be like having and this is a very simple analogy, it'd be like having a railroad car with 400, you would have 20, it'd be like having a railroad car, a train with 22 different kinds of cars, but 400 of them. Follow me? 400 cars, 22 different kinds, and each one has to be, and number one has to be number one, number two has to be number two, number three, all the way up through 400, and they all have to be facing the right direction. And so let's say it'd be like, for this to be important, you'd have to say, well, here's what would happen. down at the railroad car factory, we were putting together, we brought the materials in, but we had a contract to build 400 cars, railroad cars, for the Central Pacific Railroad, and there were 22 different kinds of them. Some were hauled steel, some were flat, you know, some were box cars, some were refrigerator cars. And so we had this contract to build 400 of 22 different kinds, and somebody set off and exploded. The thing blew up. Everything went up in the air. You never guess what came down. 400 completely constructed cars. We had all 22. We had just the right number of each of the 22. They came down hooked together. This is part of, they came down hooked together, facing in the right direction. If you believe that, you make good evolutionists. Now, by the way, it's even more complex than that. That's a very generous analogy. Y'all get that? And so if you said to somebody, well, now this is what happened. The place, somebody bombed the place. It blew up. And when all this material came down, the cars were constructed. And they were, you follow me, had just the right number. They were all in the right order. They were all hooked up, sitting on the track. If you put that in the what would happen to a teacher, to a textbook writer who put that in the textbook? You think they would get published? No, but when you word it like this, they say, that's very scientific. Yes. We'll put that in. Why? It's not really abiogenesis, but it's close. Listen, it isn't close. You understand? It isn't close enough to be respectable. It isn't anything. Well, and by the way, evolutionists, of course, admit this. And I've already talked about some of the probabilities. Well, it's just overwhelming. And that's why, really, this is one subject that evolutionists generally do ignore. They say, well, we don't know how it must have happened, and they go on from there. When I was studying at the university, one of the books my professor assigned me, on one page, it stated the problem of abiogenesis, and stated that we actually know nothing about it. And then two pages later, in referring back to abiogenesis, it said, now certainly, since this happened, it went on. And so my professor, he called me in. I said, do you have any questions? And I said, yes, I have a number of questions. And I said, here's my first question. I said, on this page, there's absolutely no knowledge. 3 pages later, it becomes certainly. And what anything said about it in between? My question is, how did no knowledge become certainty? I mean, the one thing you don't get out of this is the certainty that life came from non-life. You just don't get that. And his answer was, well, I see what you mean. Now, what do you say? Now, you should be asking me, but what do they say when they confront this? What do they really say? Do they really ignore it? Well, generally they do. And I didn't give you, by the way, I didn't give you all the problems with this. There are many other problems with these experiments that I didn't mention. I just mentioned the worst problems. Here's the answer you get. It goes something like this. Well, you see, we don't know yet, but we will. That's a very interesting question, and future scientific inquiry will undoubtedly give us the answer. Remember I said that the unwritten law of evolution is given enough time, anything can happen? There's a corollary to that. It goes like this, and I am not misrepresenting this discipline. I've worked in it. I've been there. I'm not being unfair. Nobody says, but here's the rule. You ready? And I'll close with this. Then we'll have some questions. Given enough time, anything can happen. Sorry, I didn't say it right. Given enough time in the past, anything can happen. Given enough time in the future, we'll find out how. In the meantime, be sure and be scientific and don't believe in God. In other words, this is what they're saying to our kids. They're saying, and to us. Now, we don't have any idea yet how this worked out, but we're going to find out. And trust us. And in the meantime, be sure and be scientific. Don't be a creationist. Why? Well, that is not intellectually respectable. Because we don't have your answers, the answer to your question. But we're going to have it. Just hang on. Well, that's a pretty thin stuff to build your life on, isn't it? And I would point out that if the development, and we're going to talk about this next, the development of biochemistry, if what scientific inquiry moved closer to evolution and away from creationism, they might have grounds for that, but they're going the wrong direction. In 1955 and 1960, if you were a creationist and a believer on the Secular University campus, you were in a place of ridicule. I want you to know that is no longer true. That is no longer true. Things have turned the other direction. On many of our finest universities, you have evangelical believers, those who believe the Bible is the Word of God. We have creationists, non-evolutionists teaching in the physical sciences. So things are not moving. Things are moving in our direction. Okay, any questions? Well, you've been very patient today, and I've worn you out, I know. Any questions? Yes. No, this had nothing to do with the Big Bang. Big Bang is the beginning of the universe, not the beginning of life on Earth. I don't. I suppose so. Believe the Bible is the Word of God. Believe in creation. Believe in basically. Not necessarily. I would say they don't belong to the New Testament Church. No, well, some of them do. So I wasn't making that distinction. I mean, by believer, I mean just they believe the Bible is the Word of God. And some of them are, you know, various degrees within that, but. Yes.
All right, doesn't it seem, from our kids from starting way young, it doesn't matter where it is, but it's approached factually. You know, periodically you see, maybe a TV show starts off, millions of years ago or some comet like that, not it may have. But as the youngster grows older, it doesn't just seem to be true. You find more of words like perhaps.
Yes.
All probability, the general consensus is like that as you get into different species with gender. Where did gender come from?
Well, that's the real problem. Where did the information get into the cell to tell it to become male and female? What were you asking? There's not dealt with it. Well, it must have happened. Yeah. If you think Adam and Eve and the story of the rib is ridiculous, you ought to hear their version. Listen, the Christians got... What I used to do, I'll say this. You know, for a long time, Christians... We've been kind of embarrassed to be Christians. Well, you know, you're just not really intellectual. And nope, you know, we're going to be intellectual or die. And of course, when I was in the history, which is my main field, the real issues were thrashed out in the coffee shop. You know, and I sit around with my friends. They were good friends. They were still my friends, you know, the fellows I work with. And a couple of them were Christians. And so I used to say to the fellows, they always act like, oh, you're a Christian. That's, you believe the Bible. That's very interesting. That's very, you know, like you got three heads. Oh, yeah. So I'd say, you don't believe in the resurrection of Jesus? I find that very strange. You sure you don't? And I used to act very amazed. Put them on the defensive. You don't believe in canon one historical testimony? Well, yeah, but why don't you believe in that? Well, you see, you know, you let them explain themselves. Listen, the truth's on our side. We got the evidence.
Yeah.
And so I do the same thing with the evolution. They say, well, you know, you're a creationist. I said, aren't you? They say, well, no. I said, well, why not? You're actually an evolutionist. Yeah. That's right. You believe in abiogenesis? Well, yeah. I find that very strange. Have you discovered some evidence for it? Well, not exactly, but have you seen the problems with the Miller-Urey experiment and all the negatives in that paradigm? This doesn't explain the tar out of themselves. I mean, why should we do the explaining? You see? We got the probabilities. See? So I just thought, and I had a great time making, you know, let them defend themselves. Why should we always be on the defensive? Well, I'm not trying to entertain you. I'm trying to teach you. Yes.
I thought you'd find this amazing. The wife and I, every Saturday morning, we so like to get up, you know, bright and early and watch the cartoons. We really got a kick out of the cartoons until they started teaching, of all things, evolution. Showing Bugs Bunny working on it, showing how this happened and that happened.
Oh, yeah. Fred Flintstone, and which isn't really an evolution. Any other questions? Yes, ma'am. Yes, sir.
I'm sorry. Bad eyes.
No. There aren't very many. All that were on the ark were only the kinds of air-breathing animals. And there aren't very many kinds of air-breathing animals. The ark was much bigger than it had to be to get all the kinds of air-breathing animals. And that was all that was on the ark. No. But not it had to been. Much evidence for that, because many of the kinds are no longer here. Many of the varieties are no longer here. For instance, the dinosaurs are still here. The big kind are not. The big variety of dinosaur, or not. But as a kind, they're still here and always have been. The alligator is a dinosaur. The cockroach is a dinosaur. Several brands of lizards are dinosaurs, follow me? They were contemporary of that age, whenever the dinosaurs lived. I don't get into that here. But the varieties, the larger varieties are gone. Somebody suggests, by the way, one of the reasons a lot of these... smaller kind don't get bigger is because they die. Many kinds of reptiles grow all their life. And if they had a long time to grow, they would become as big as some of the dinosaurs were. The larger varieties. I have no idea. It's a possibility. I don't know how inclusive the language is. It says every kind. That's assuming a universal flood, which I do assume. I think that it's not, the matter's not settled yet. I entertain the possibility of a, not a small flood, but a, not a universal flood. that was anthropologically universal, killed all men, but necessarily all animals. I don't think that's true, but the Bible doesn't exclude that. The language of the Bible doesn't. But there's no problem either way. Yes. Not very much. Some, perhaps. I'm trying to cover what I think is the most important. I'm being arbitrary. We'd be here for 2-3 weeks. We covered everything. I would just say this in general, sort of a general, the area in which that discussion takes place, in my opinion. Remember I said last night that the study of really big Old Testament studies are in their infancy in many ways, some ways. And so is the world of science. And it's turning to the field of geology. The real geology is very confusing for a couple of reasons. One is that textbook geology is not the same as field geology. Now, that is a common complaint not raised by creationists but by evolutionists. The nice, neat little arrangement, the nice, neat stratification that you find in the textbooks is absolutely not what you find when you go dig. What uniformitarian, that is, what evolutionary geologists tend to do is focus on where it does fit and ignore where it doesn't fit. What flood geologists do is focus on where it doesn't fit and ignore where it seems to fit. But the evidence is very conflicting as far as dates and times. And I think we need to, in other words, I think I have more question marks. I think we ought to, many things, I think, I have my views based upon what is now, I think, is known. But what I'm saying is the evidence we're working with, the data, is in very bad shape, by the way. I got a friend who's a non-instrument Church of Christ lay preacher, you should call him, he's not a full-time preacher, he's a geologist in Orlando. We work together in the creation organization, and he's a master's degree in geology, and he studied at, I forget which university, one in the East, under a man who's not a creationist. But this man was a field geologist for years, and then came into the classroom, and one of the things he drove home was, according to my friend, that textbook geology is very nice. And if you want to enjoy that nice, neat little package, stay in the classroom. Don't get out there with your shovel. Because what you actually find is much more complicated than that. You see, what we call the geologic time scale is a mental construct. There's no place on earth you can dig down and find it. You can find what seem to be sections of it in various places. The problem is you look at other places and you find the sections are out of order. Or they're upside down. Or they're standing on their head, or they got the wrong kind of fossils in them. And this has been I don't bring it with me, but I just bring catalog journal articles where hundreds of examples of what they call anomalies. So what I'm saying is, regardless of what view you take of Genesis, how you interpret Genesis, I think we've got some problems in relating it to the geologic record, because the geologic, that question is in a state of confusion. So I think we'll be very careful. Now, the question what we might ask is, what about this dating? It's a question of a recent Earth, a young Earth, or an old Earth. And I can outline for you if you'd like. I don't know if you have time. There was much evidence for a young Earth. I believe in a comparatively young Earth. And I believe in a comparatively young Earth, although I do admit the possibility that there may have been a longer time gap than we think between the beginning of creation and the coming of Adam. The earth may have been around longer before Adam was created than we have traditionally thought. Now, this is based not simply on some things that seem to appear in the geologic record, but it's based on the language of Scripture. We must not act like, well, the language of Scripture is very clearly and categorically outlines 24 successive days, you know, one creation week as we know it. It may possibly do that, but there's some real language, there's some real problems with what the Bible says from the language that's used. You know what I mean? It's not a question of believing the Bible or not. It's a question of understanding what is being said. Now, so what I'm saying is I believe there's much evidence for a young earth, which the uniformitarians ignore. On the other hand, the creationists, to be honest with you, flood geologists ignore some evidence too, or what seems to be evidence. Now, this may disappoint you that I just won't plant a flag and give you a date. But in my opinion, I think it's too early to do that. And I'm encouraged in this because the more that is known, the more sound the biblical position comes. It's all going in the right direction. And I'm content with that, to develop maybe a wait-and-see attitude. Now, I like flood geology. If I had to defend a position, I would defend that. I think it makes more sense. But I do not categorically discard any other explanation, such as progressive days, you know, or days with gaps, because I think the evidence is too confusing. And keep in mind, the Bible is not that explicit. It is history, but it is very brief history. And for instance, it raised some real questions. For instance, was God giving Moses a scientific explanation of creation, or was God giving Moses the kind of glimpse at the creation process that he could understand? And there's precedence for that elsewhere in Scripture. Now, I'm telling you, in either case, it's history. It's sober history, but the character of it is what I'm saying. And I think Christians ought to be, we've made a big mistake in the past, is we have planted our flag too early. And you see, the basic question between creation and evolution, we should not lose the battle because we defend an undefendable creation position. We shouldn't make the same mistake the evolutionists have made. They planted their flag and then had to take it up and move it. And we've planted our flag and had to take it up and move it. And it's because we're in the infancy of this debate is in its infancy, in my opinion. So no telling how it's going to come out. So you see, I believe the Bible as history. And I think you made my position clear in this series. But I do not think that the question of exactly what is the Bible saying is an easy question. That's all I'm saying. And I think we ought to be free to look at many possibilities. I'm not arguing for theistic evolution, of course. That's bad science and bad theology both. That isn't good anything. That's the cop-out. That's the easy way out. God created the world through evolution. Understand? It doesn't become good science by attaching God's name to it. Either it's good science or it's not good science. It doesn't become good science by mixing it with theology. It's also bad theology. I'm a creationist. I am absolutely certain that God created the world. All the scientific evidence shows creation. Now, it's a question of exactly when, and in some cases exactly how. I think we ought to go slow. That's all I'm saying. Now, if you're not satisfied with that, I apologize. But that's my position. Now, again, I'm not arguing for... I generally think a comparatively young Earth is what the evidence shows. Question? Yes?
Isn't it strange, though, that man, in his quest for his knowledge, he has to extend the time? It's the creation of the Earth is the Earth, 3 to 6 days. And that man will extend it.
And I am generally suspicious of the long Earth, the long, vast ages of Earth position. The reason I'm suspicious of it is, I don't trust some of their data, some of their presentation of the data, for this reason, that I know from studying the history of it, that they are philosophically required to have a long amount of time. They didn't come to it fairly. Whether it's true or not, they cheated. That is, they said, well, we know the Earth, for one thing, they would say, put it this way, we know the Earth has existed for millions and billions of years. Why? It must have. Why? Because if you're going to have a system that won't work, it helps to give it a lot of time. Yeah. It seems respectable. And by the way, it's not respectable. Time, in creation, time is the creative dynamic. Well, of course it won't work in the laboratory, but you've got to understand over a billion years. But you see, time... Are you interested in this? Time decreases probability if a system doesn't work. Our system, the ecological system, overwhelmingly takes that which is living and makes it dead, takes that which is highly organized and makes it lower organized. Devolution. Horizontal. There's any question if that's ever happened. Now, if you add time, all you get is a worse problem. Like, suppose I said to you, here's how I'm going to operate. That's point A, and that's point B. That point A is 500 miles that way, and point B is 500 miles that way. Or maybe they could be at infinity, whatever it is. Okay? I am going to take one half step in this direction, and then I'm going to turn, and I'm going to take 100 steps in this direction. And then I'm going to turn around, and I'm going to take one half step in this direction. And then I'm going to turn, and I'm going to take another 100 steps in that direction. Now, which point would I get to, point first? Would I arrive at point A or point B? Answer? You don't understand. I'm going to do this forever. I'm going to do this for 100 million years. Well, in that case, you'll get to point A first. No, you won't. The longer you do it, the farther away from point A you get. Time doesn't do it. That's why, by the way, critics of evolution, among the evolutionists themselves, point out that that neo-Darwinism, the whole scheme, because it's based upon chance, explains an earth, a lifeless earth, a barren, lifeless earth, better than it explains the one we've got. The system, perfectly, if we had an earth, there was nothing here. It was like the moon. Nude, lifeless. And so it would explain that better than it explains the one we've got. So time, you see, what they do is they hit you with that time. Well, but over a million years, you see, I see your point. In that case, I can see how it might happen. But listen, non-life doesn't produce life. It goes the other way. Things tend to die. Time just increases the tendency. Increases the result. Well, let's be dismissed. We've taken too much time. I don't know what the plan is. I'll turn back over to you.